Welcome to the Mindfulness Podcast. This is David Black. My guest is Dr. Darren Dunning. He is a scientist at the Medical Research Council, Cognition and Brain Sciences Unit, University of Cambridge in the UK. He's also a senior research advisor for the National Institute for Health and Care Research in the UK. His research focuses on mindfulness interventions for children and adolescents. Welcome, Dr. Dunning. It's great to have you. I took an interest in your new article. Let me give the title here. Do mindfulness-based programs improve the cognitive skills, behavior, and mental health health of children and adolescents? An updated meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials. So I really became interested in your work because I have a long history of attending to this field. Way back in 2007, as a PhD student, I told my advisor, I really would like to write a review here because there's so few studies and I wonder if there's something that possibly works. And that ultimately was published in Pediatrics. And I was shocked because there weren't a lot of medical journals accepting this type of work. So meditation studies. That one was called, I didn't like the name, but the reviewer changed. I think we were focused on mindfulness meditation. But it ultimately was sitting meditation interventions among youth, a review of treatment efficacy. And the reason we did that, because we were trying to show that this wasn't physical activity. So our work aligns. So tell me about your background and what made you want to conduct this review.
Okay. So maybe it'd be useful to go back. This is an updated review. So it was an updated one of one that was published in 2019. And then I'd been working in working memory research for quite a few years, and then I made the sideways jump over to mindfulness. I say it's sideways because they're both really concerned with how we deal with current information. But because I'd made this change, I had a lot of reading to do. So I started to do the reading, and I thought I may as well get something out of this as well. So I decided to do a meta-analysis. And that took about 2.5-3 years because while I was writing it, two others come out. Like you, I looked and there was nothing else really out there. And I was I thought this would be a nice paper. And it proved to be in the end, but we had to really jump through a few hoops and kept going back and improving ours. So we had something new to say. So the 2019 one that one that we'll talk about was updated, was 33 randomized control trials that compared mindfulness training against a control group. So that could be an active or a passive control group. And the results suggested that mindfulness was useful on a whole host of outcomes when compared to passive groups, so compared to weightless controls or teaching as usual. But when you compare them to active control groups, it was only really useful for improving mental health outcomes, so as anxiety and depression, which we were quite pleased about because that was why really mindfulness was developed as an intervention to, you know, reduce stress and to prevent depressive relapse. So that was that one. Then I was involved in the Myriad project, which was, I don't know if you know the Myriad project. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, you can tell us.
It's a sort of a large definitive trial, but a suite of studies, really. The biggest one was comparing mindfulness against a passive control group with children aged between 11 and 14. There was 8,400 of them. And basically, the primary outcomes were anxiety, depression, and well-being, and we didn't find that there was any benefit of mindfulness. So on top of the Myriad study, which we know kind of would make a big difference to any meta-analysis, there'd been a few other large-scale trials. So 3 years later, we decided to update the 2019 one. And what we did find was that where we had 33 RCTs before, there was now 66. And where we looked at about 3,500 individuals in those 33 trials initially. Now there was over 20,000, so the whole field had really exploded.
And so you began this work, and what was your objective of this current review? So you had this new information. You had previously known there's a certain level of evidence. New evidence is kind of contradicting that when you have this large trial and comparing it to active controls. And then you had this newer review that came out. And so what was the objective now with that new awareness?
We were looking really to see if our initial findings still held up, and that it was still, even despite the no findings in Myriad, that it would still be successful. It would still have promise. And we didn't find that, really.
So yeah, let's go through that, because yeah. I want to show the complexity of trying to pull something off like this. So conducting a study is hard enough in its own way, and in a review and meta-analysis, depending on how you're handling it, if this is like a data collection from all studies and a meta-analysis or a review taking the results of current studies that have been published, it still takes a lot of work to get those studies, select those studies, and determine which are relevant. So I'm looking at one of your figures, and this is classic, a flow chart of your inclusion in studies. And it shows that you started with the amount of records, like over 3,000 studies. Yeah. And then you have to keep reducing down to what is reasonable. So just briefly, do you want to mention the complexity of that process, how you pulled it off, so we know that this end result of studies is reasonable to interpret?
Yeah. So initially, I mean, the first one in 2019, I wouldn't say it was a one-man band, but I did most of the heavy lifting. For this one, it was so much bigger, and the time frame was so much shorter. It was actually ridiculous to attempt it in the first place, but we managed to pull it off because we threw a lot of people at it. There was kind of lots of people helping with, the other data search and pulling out the other salient information from the papers that were suitable. So it was a big undertaking. For people that like that sort of thing, there's over 100 pages of supplemental materials online. So the paper itself is quite short, but we've got everything in this. It was a labor of love.
Oh, so really. All your procedural information. So that's useful. And so you say it might be a little mundane, but for those who want to replicate this and hear it, for any graduate students listening, that might be useful to go look at those 100 pages to see a document to be able to do the similar.
I think that's really where the gold is, David. I think that's where the gold is. You know, I think that, I mean,
the paper gives... The method is where the gold is.
It gives a nice overview, the other paper, but the real sort of information's in the supplemental stuff. We couldn't include that. And our reviewers that we had for the paper were really good, and they pushed us, and they really made us do as, you know, as good a job as we could. And I'm pretty proud of it, to be fair.
Yeah, well, and that's a win for science, right? And I do recall that. So here's another... similar experience that we've had together. When I originally submitted that to pediatrics, I really wanted a good review group. We ended up were assigned to, I don't know who they are, but 5 reviewers, and they all came back. And I think I cycled that through 4 iterations, 5 iterations. It almost broke me. I remember being a PhD student, like, oh, wow, this is good. Like, this is the kind of feedback we're looking for. So I'm glad we're both. And that's how it should be, especially when you're trying to do a synthesis to make a claim about the interpretation of for a field, right? It's so important. So I'm so happy that is alive and well as part of the scientific method. That's one of the tools we use, peer review, blinded feedback, hopefully. And it looks like you got that here. And you also produce this really important protocol that people can find online in your supplemental material. Yeah. So that's awesome. Yeah. So from those 3,254, your team widowed that down into 37. And that's where you really have found here's the similarity across studies that we can unify and pull an evidence claim from. So tell me about that last 37. What made those unique?
So they all had to have used a bit, how best to describe it. So they all had to be with people aged under 18 years. I realized there's quite a lot of variation within that, but they all had to be randomized control trials. They all had to have used a certain type of mindfulness, so sort of based on, we couldn't include things like mindful yoga, mindful coloring, anything like that. These had to be sort of, the central tenets of mindfulness. You have to, so kind of, focusing on the present, decentering from intrusive thoughts, and returning to the present. And it had to be conducted by a trained mindfulness teacher as well. So there's so many studies out there that you think it's going to be good enough, or it's going to be, well, good enough to not really fair, going to be sort of able to be included. And then you go, nope, actually it can't. And it had to be over a series of sessions. So there's some that will do it over sort of a 15-minute session. And so one session will make you mindfulness, will make you better at golf or something. It would be something like that. And we had to exclude all those that didn't use one of our primary outcomes or two. So that's mental health. We looked at behavior. We looked at positive and negative behavior. We looked at well-being. We looked at executive function. So we were quite inclusive, but to be included in those 37 had to tick each of those boxes.
And it's some of them, it wasn't a lot. I think 14 in total were excluded because they didn't have, as you mentioned, the relevant outcomes. So as you said, maybe we weren't looking at golf in those cases. And some don't have the available data after you contacted the authors to calculate effect size. And sometimes it's just hard to determine given the results and the data that's shown in the manuscript sometimes. Reporting standards have improved. So usually I think it is better than it used to be. So you should be able to find, raw means, standard deviations on mean estimates on all those things to calculate effect size and sample size. But sometimes we know with a story of a publication, sometimes it's not there. Okay, so you ultimately examined 37. I think in my original review, there were 16. There were similar criteria to yours. So less than half. And that's over a decade later. And so that's what I want to learn about, what's happened since. And let's touch on one more point, because this is an important point. You looked at a risk of bias as in part of your evidence assessment. Do you want to say what that is? Because that's become more and more important. And we look at this, you report on the grading of recommendations, assessment, development, evaluation as high, moderate, and low, or very low. Do you want to tell us what that is?
So basically, if you would, even though maybe a study reported that it was a randomized control trial, maybe when you read the paper, they didn't explain what the randomization process was. They didn't say how they dealt with missing outcome data, or there was a Leniency effect. I think there's six different criteria that we looked at, and if they didn't specifically state that we did this, we'd have to say that the risk of bias was unclear. We couldn't say that without a doubt this study did, sort of outcome raters needed to be blinded as well. We didn't always, even though you would hope that was the case in an RCT, if they didn't state that, then we couldn't say without any doubt that this, didn't that people weren't blinded. For
So
instance.
this is an important change. I remember in writing the original review, the reviewers didn't make this. I can't remember what year this came out. We might want to look at what that grade your citation is. But this wasn't as important then. Seems to have become much more important because I think the preponderance of people publishing meta-analyses and reviews and research teams, there's a research team at Stanford that's kind of critiqued too many reviews and too little evidence produced from those reviews. So having things like this, and I'm glad your team did this, is very useful. So you're saying, here is the claim that we're making, and it's based either on high level evidence, low level evidence, et cetera. So that helps with our precision. So I was happy.
Something like Leniency effects, kind of, rather than so many researchers don't use an off-the-shelf version of mindfulness, they will do their bespoke version of mindfulness, which, they've got skin in the game there. It's there's a question of bias.
Yeah, because we don't know.
One example.
Yeah, the researcher wants to know in hopefully a standardized intervention package, what can we say about the independent variable? I think a lot of the times we still don't know what the independent variable is. And I think this is classic for behavior and social sciences. We refer to them as intervention packages. And this comes from like the field of behavior analysis, that what is the true independent variable? Well, we don't know. So we call it an intervention package worth of 8 weeks of material. So I'm glad you did that as well. At least you got clear. At least you're indicating that as close as we can say that an intervention practice was MBSR or MBRP. Did you include like MBCT?
Yeah.
All of these like MBSR family, basically.
Yeah.
So things like acceptance commitment therapy, that is a whole nother different kind of package.
Yeah, exactly.
DBT is a whole nother kind of package.
Yeah. So we didn't include those. And the good thing with the risk of bringing risk of bias as well is that we can use that as a moderator in a regression analysis. We can look to see if the quality of the studies suggests that there's an overinflation of effect sizes, or for instance, we can use that in a different way. So we can see if quality of studies is affecting the results.
And so in terms of quality on that system that your group is using, that grade system, what were the number of studies that kind of met this quality? I wonder in total, how many quality RCTs do we have out of the 37?
I don't know if there was any that we felt satisfied every one of the criteria. I could be wrong, but if there was any, it was just one or two.
That's informative.
I think
we want high quality studies.
Good. Yeah, I was just quite good because we knew.
No bias in that.
Perhaps a little bit. Yeah. So
no, I like your point. Ours was good, and can you finish? It was an RCT. If I'm getting this right, tell me. So active control condition. What was the active control in the Myriad trial?
Well, there was a few different trials as part of the Myriad project. So the main one was a passive control group. So it was teaching as usual. So it was pushing against an open door, really, and we still didn't find that there was a benefit of mindfulness over doing nothing. But I think I can explain why that might be. If you want to get into that now, should we talk about that now?
Let's finish up on the trial and then you can open up on that previous work. So I'm looking at your reporting of results. You have some beautiful tables here. Let's talk about some of these outcomes that, because in a review, you always have to make the decision, like, which outcomes are we talking about here? And you definitely want enough studies to make a claim about that outcome. So you need all your studies to share a similar outcome. You report on anxiety, stress, attention, depression, executive function, mindfulness levels, something called negative behavior and social behavior, as well as others. So there's a lot. That means the field is kind of examining these various outcomes. What did you take from that? What did you take from these varying outcomes? Is there a strength for a certain outcome, a weakness for another?
How you measure these outcomes is important as well. So if you think about something like depression, somebody might claim that they've got a measure of depression and it might be two questions that they've thought up themselves as opposed to somebody running the back. So we had to look at each of the outcomes and we ranked them. We made a hierarchy of outcomes based on how often they used, sort of their statistical properties and things like that as well. So we had to even look at each of the outcomes, what people used as an outcome measurement. So that was important too. What we found, I suppose, the take home of the study was that mindfulness, I still feel, is useful for improving ratings of anxiety. So even against active control groups. Have I misunderstood your question, actually, Dave?
No, keep going. No, this is good. We want to understand the... We can head into results. So I was just looking at these different features that you looked at targets, which tells us that researchers presume that the same intervention package affects a lot of different dependent variables.
Yeah.
But I wanted to get your claim after running this about where is the strength? Like, was there strength in one region for an outcome, a strength not in on another outcome? Was that clear at all coming through on this review?
Not really, but it's still mainly used. I mean, mindfulness is still mainly used for mental health measures, and the quality of the outcomes used far, far better than something like negative behavior, which might be one question on a checklist.
And then, so you looked at the effect sizes, and this is a nice comparison because it's standardized and you can look at it across the various outcomes. Did anything stand out as being both significant and at least moderate or better, where the evidence was the studies were well conducted?
It was anxiety. Okay, so we still feel that it's mindfulness is quite good at improving ratings of anxiety, improving anxiety levels.
Okay, so with looking at all of these
I should say reducing anxiety levels, not improving them.
I know what you mean. So this is among people younger, these are children and adolescents, people younger than 18.
Yeah.
The intervention package, when well-designed, as you're talking about, well-designed within the family of MBSR and using an active control, so we can say that it was actually compared against something that had value. You're saying there's still an effect for anxiety, stress levels. So that's a good finding for the field. it seems to be perhaps creating an improvement in the direction that we would want to see improvement being made. Were there other areas? So that's like on the positive note, were there any outcomes where the evidence was good and we had a pretty definitive claim about it not working?
So in the first meta-analysis, we found that depression, but with the new studies, the influx of new studies, it was absolutely nowhere. It was flat as a pancake. There was no improvement whatsoever for depression. Most of the other ones were in the right kind of direction. Depression was quite flat, which was a real surprise.
Well, I wonder as well, like depressive symptoms or scores, how that's measured. Is there already kind of a floor effect? I don't know how many youth are going to score very high on that. So maybe that's one question. Were you able to tease that out? Are there enough people reporting very high that we can have that kind of effect? Or do you think it's just a challenging thing to address with a behavioral intervention?
I think that one thing that we noticed, so as part of our trial, we used a depression outcome called the CESD, and that gives you a cutoff for risk of depression, and roughly 40% of our group were at risk of depression. Young people are having it really hard at the moment, I think. There were in our sample, I can't speak for the other studies included, but in a myriad, we had very, very high levels of depression.
And in table two, you have a follow-up assessment. Did any other outcomes last, the improvement last? And did anxiety last? And if it did, to what time frame?
Yeah, that was probably the most kind of disappointing result, that nothing was sustained. There was no positive effects sustained. And follow-up range from 3 months to about a year. And within that, we found no results that were sustained.
Okay, and so this... you have a figure too that's really interesting about where the bias comes from. So I think this is another very interesting methods piece that your group adds, which is, you know, where are the risks coming from? So for the field, so if we're going to like give some news to the field about where this, where we can improve, where might we start? Like, what's the hierarchy, maybe the top two or three things we should do better in this field?
I think we should start to use the same kinds of mindfulness interventions. So, and I think this is MBSR and CBT, because there's so much noise, I think, within these groups and using different these are latency effects with the biggest risk of bias in the whole thing. So somebody using their own version of mindfulness. So I think that, yeah.
So if we're going to make a clear, let me know if I'm getting you right here. If we're going to make a clear claim about what evidence we have in the field, we're going to need to do better with the intervention package, like
make it as tight as
we can, either to the original MBSR program, MBCT program, MBRP program. And that requires, and I've written on this too, it's complex. When you're starting to do fidelity, both training and assessment, that means you have to have qualified teachers. That means that you are video recording, audio recording, getting raters and observers to look. And there are checklists that various groups have published. So there's a way to do it well. So maybe we're speaking to the opportunity for researchers to build that in to the project. Is an important piece. Make sure we're delivering the independent variable as intended. Okay, give me one more. So that's a key one. And then what do you think second in a rank ordering?
Well, I think my instinct is that, there's a few things in that. So we know from, again, the Myriad trial, which was this 8,400 children, that even though they were happy to go to mindfulness class and they enjoyed it, they did not practice at home. And mindfulness was an hour a week, 1 hour per week, the mindfulness class. And I think to expect big improvements in something like anxiety or depression ratings after 8 hours over 8 weeks is expecting a bit too much.
Would that fall under your bias from deviations from intended interventions? So they're deviating from both dose or deviation from classroom activities.
Exactly. They don't, because as part of their mindfulness classes, they're supposed to practice at home as well for 20 minutes a night, and they didn't do that.
That's the challenge, right? The behavior, the effect is in the behavior.
They've got Netflix and smartphones.
So, the effect is in the behavior. So if the behavior is not happening, right? It's the same thing as the studying behavior, right? So if you go to class and you have your homework and you're not doing your homework, you're wondering why the test scores aren't changing. Well, the practice wasn't there. So I think that's a well-known thing. How do we get people to practice the behavior?
Yeah.
And the effort is usually in daily life. That's a recommendation. And then there was one more that kind of stands out. If I'm looking at where the highest risk came from in your figure, bias in the randomization process. What do we mean by that one? How can we improve that?
Well, more transparency. There's quite a few cluster randomized trials, which is okay if you've got something like we had 80 something schools, so that's not too bad. But if you've got two schools and you randomize one to mindfulness and one to the control condition, then I think that there's all sorts of things that could be going on there. You know, where are the schools based in demographic factors? Are you truly randomizing those schools? And quite a few do things like that.
And so taking all this hard work, this very strong protocol, supplemental material, all this effort, and presentation of these results and bias in the field, can you help make a claim? What do you think is the final take home from all this work, the main contribution for a science of behavior and for wellness?
I'm going to write a paper and I'm going to call it, you can take a young person to mindfulness class, but you can't make them mindful. Because we need to have I think we've also, what we do is we expect them to learn mindfulness and then to be able to use that flexibly in situations where they might need it. And I think that we miss a step. We don't teach them how to use mindfulness. We just teach them to be mindful, and we presume that that would have a knock-on effect on their lives. You know, we miss a step out, I think, that we need to sort of be a bit more prescriptive. And this is so if you're feeling, so if you think of anxiety in a really simple way, if you think of mental health problems as anxiety being kind of caught up in things that haven't happened yet, depression in ruminating on things in the past, if you can control where your head goes, your that mental time travel aspect, then you could use mindfulness when you are feeling anxious or feeling a bit sad. But we don't teach these young people that.
I think it's a really important point. And the medium for how to make that happen is especially challenging with youth. I was just in my last podcast, I met with David Gröning, and he's at Heidelberg University in Germany. And he was working on this one app. He didn't do any mindfulness training on the app, but it's an app called One Sec. And you imagine, I mean, he was, you know, there's 6 billion people now using smartphones, and the amount among youth is like 90%. So they are a captive audience for sure. And our discussion was about his One Sec, like trying to use nudges and behavioral economics to make sure people have intention. So it's like, are you sure you want to open this app? And then we were talking at the end, like, what if we said, like, do you want to open this app? And then added an additional nudge, which is, would you be willing to do a 5-minute mindfulness practice right now? And it, you know, the question is, how are we going to get people to behave? Because we know there's just so many competing awesome things to do. And especially young people on their phones. I mean, how do we compete with scrolling through what your friends are doing? That's going to be the biggest challenge, right? Maybe that's why they're not meditating after our courses.
I think there's also the fact that I think young people are different to adults, and the fact that I think adults will go to an 8-week course and they would, sorry, someone's trying to call me, very distracting on Teams. Yeah, so when they go to an 8-week course, they're probably a bit more motivated to be there. They're still trying to call. I'm going to just,
that's okay. Well, it's thank you so much for your contribution to this work.
Let me say it again, David, please.
Please.
If that's okay.
Of course.
Yeah. So I think that most of the kids that have been in the large trials have just been sort of a sample of typical individuals that don't have the motivation to want to improve any aspect of their lives. Especially, they might be interested, but they don't want to. They don't have the same investment that someone like an adult that is going to a mindfulness class for 8 weeks that might be going for kind of a specific reason. They might go because they've got to go or they feel that they should go.
There's that selection element, right? So you're an adult. You've seen the world of your children and of the stressors and challenges and setbacks, and you're like, you know, there's a value system that's engaging me in this practice. Whereas, you know, young students are just like, what is going on in this world? And here's this one program that these adults are trying to engage me with. And their adults are trying to engage me with everything. And here's just another thing. So yeah, point well taken. And that's why it connects to that earlier discussion about the app. It's like, what are young people doing? And how do we build from that and extend out to a value system that goes beyond seeing what other people are doing in this world, which is kind of where we're at, information grabs that are endless. Well, I thank you so much for your work. Thank you for delivering on that protocol for everyone in the field who wants to run any type of review and meta-analysis here. And I'm glad we have this contribution that we can be very sober about our claims about the field of mindfulness training for young people. It seems like there could be some effects on anxiety, stress. When you look at the strongest evidence, there hasn't really panned out strength in other areas to this point. So it makes sense. That's what the program was built for. But we definitely need some strong studies, as pointed out, especially those that have very strong fidelity. They're delivering the treatment and the intervention variable as intended. So thank you so much for your time, Dr. Dunning. It's been great talking with you.
Same time next week?
Listeners, same time next week. Listeners can subscribe on Spotify and Audible. Bye now.